Solid True. Azazel by Isaac Asimov. Continuing with The Dim Rumble on page 42. He frowned at me, sipped at his drink, then tapped his chest. The Lord has placed a weapon in my hand, and I must learn to use it.
What weapon is this? I asked.
He didn't answer directly. I found the cave quite by accident, he said.
Something I welcome, for any cave whose opening advertises itself too openly is common property and has been host to thousands. Show me an opening narrow and hidden, one that is overgrown with vegetation, obscured by fallen rocks, veiled by a waterfall, precariously placed in an all but inaccessible spot, and I will show you a virgin cave worthy of inspection.
You say you know nothing of speleology? I have been in caves, of course, I said.
The Luray Caverns in Virginia.
Commercial, said West, screwing up his face and looking about for a convenient spot on the floor upon which to spit.
Fortunately, he didn't find one.
Since you know nothing about the divine joys of spelunking, he went on, I will not bore you with any account of where I found it and how I explored it. It is, of course, not always safe to explore new caves without companions, but I perform solo explorations readily.
After all, there is no one who can match me in this sort of expertise, to say nothing of the fact that I am as bold as a lion.
In this case, it was indeed fortunate I was alone,
for it would not have done for any other human being to discover what I discovered.
I had been exploring for several hours when I entered a large and silent room with stalactites above and stalagmites below in gorgeous profusion. I skirted about the stalagmites, trailing my unwinding twine behind me, since I am not fond of losing my way, and then I came across what must have been a thick stalagmite that had broken off at some natural plane of cleavage. There was a litter of limestone to one side of it. What had caused the break, I cannot say. Perhaps some large animal fleeing into the cave under pursuit had blundered into the stalagmite in the dark. Or else a mild earthquake had found this one stalagmite weaker than others. In any case, the stump of the stalagmite was now topped by a smooth flatness, just moist enough to glisten in my electric light. It was roughly round and strongly resembled a drum. So strongly did it resemble one that I automatically reached out and tapped it with my right forefinger.
He gulped down the rest of his drink and said, It was a drum, or at least it was a structure that set up a vibration when tapped. As soon as I touched it, a dim rumble filled the room, a vague sound just at the threshold of hearing and all but subsonic.
Indeed, as I was able to determine later on, the portion of the sound that was high enough in pitch to be heard was a tiny fraction of the whole. Almost all the sound expressed itself in mighty vibrations, far too slow to affect the ear, though it shook the body itself.
That unheard reverberation gave me the most unpleasantly uneasy feeling you could imagine. I had never encountered such a phenomenon before. The energy of my touch had been minute. How could it have been converted into such a mighty vibration? I have never managed to understand that completely. To be sure, there are powerful energy sources underground. There could be a way of tapping the heat of the magma, converting a small portion of it to sound. The initial tap could serve to liberate additional sound energy, a kind of sonic laser. Or, if we substitute sound for light in the acronym, we can call it SASER.
I said austerely, I've never heard of such a thing.
No, said West with an unpleasant sneer. I dare say you haven't. It is nothing anyone has heard of. Some combination of geologic arrangements has produced a natural SASER. It is something that would not happen by accident, more often than once in a million years, perhaps, and even then in only one spot on the planet. It may be the most unusual phenomenon on Earth.
That's a great deal, I said, to deduce from one tap of a forefinger.
As a scientist, sir, I assure you I was not satisfied with a single tap of a forefinger. I proceeded to experiment. I tried harder taps and quickly realized that I could be seriously damaged by the reverberations in the enclosure. I set up a system whereby I could drop pebbles of various sizes on the Caesar by means of a makeshift long-distance apparatus while I was outside the cave. I discovered that the sound could be heard surprising distances outside the cave. Using a simple seismometer, I found that I could get distinct vibrations at distances of several miles. Eventually, I dropped a series of pebbles one after the other, and the effect was cumulative. I said, "Was that the day when dim rumbles were heard all over the world?" "Exactly," he said. "You are by no means as mentally deprived as you appear. The whole planet rang like a bell." "I've heard particularly strong earthquakes do that." "Yes, but this Caesar can produce a vibration more intense than that of any earthquake, and can do so at particular wavelengths. At a wavelength, for instance, that can shake apart the contents of cells. The nucleic acids of the chromosomes, for instance." I considered that thoughtfully. "That would kill the cell." "It certainly would. That may be what killed the dinosaurs."
"I've heard it was done by the collision of an asteroid with the Earth."
"Yes, but in order to have that done by ordinary collision, the asteroid postulated must be huge, 10 kilometers across. And one must suppose dust in the stratosphere, a 3-year winter, and some way of explaining why some species died out and others didn't in a most illogical fashion. Suppose, instead, that it was a much smaller asteroid that struck a Caesar, and that it disrupted cells with its sound vibration. Perhaps 90% of the cells in the world would be destroyed in a matter of minutes, with no enormous effect on the planetary environment at all. Some species would manage to survive, some would not. It would be entirely a matter of the intimate details of comparative nucleic acid structure." "And that," I said, with a most unpleasant feeling that this fanatic was serious, "is the weapon the Lord has placed into your hands?" "Exactly," he said. "I have worked out the exact wavelengths of sound produced by various manners of tapping the Caesar, and I am trying now to determine which wavelength would specifically disrupt human nucleic acids."
"Why human?" I demanded.
"Why not human?" demanded he in his turn. "What species is crowding the planet, destroying the environment, eradicating other species, filling the biosphere with chemical pollutants? What species will destroy the Earth and render it totally non-viable in a matter of decades, perhaps? Surely not some other than Homo sapiens. If I can find the right sonic wavelength, I can strike my Caesar in the proper manner and with the proper force to bathe the Earth in sonic vibrations that will, in a matter of a day or so, for it takes time for sound to travel, wipe out humanity while scarcely touching other life forms with nucleic acids of differing intimate structure." I said, "You are prepared to destroy billions of human beings? The Lord did it by means of the flood. Surely you don't believe the biblical tale of the..." West said austerely, "I am a creationist geologist, sir."
I understood everything.
"Ah," I said, "and the Lord promised he would never again send a flood upon the earth, but he didn't say anything about sound waves." "Exactly. The billions of dead will fertilize and fructify the earth, serve as food for other forms of life which have suffered much at the hands of humanity and deserve recompense. What's more, a remnant of humanity shall undoubtedly survive. There are bound to be a few human beings who will have nucleic acids of a type that will not be sensitive to the sonic vibrations. That remnant, blessed by the Lord, can begin anew and will perhaps have learned a lesson as to the evil of evil, so to speak." I said, "Why are you telling me all this?" And indeed, it had occurred to me that it was strange he was doing so. He leaned toward me and seized me by the lapel of my jacket. a most unpleasant experience, for his breath was rather overpowering, and said, "I have the inner certainty that you can help me in my work." I said, "I assure you that I haven't any knowledge whatsoever concerning wavelengths, nucleic acids, and..." But then, bethinking myself rapidly, I said, "Yet come to think of it, I may have just the thing for you." And in a more formal voice, with the stately courtesy that is one of my characteristics, I said, "Would you do me the honor, sir, of waiting for me for perhaps 15 minutes? "Certainly, sir," he answered with equal formality. "I will occupy myself with further abstruse mathematical calculations." As I hastened out of the lounge, I passed a $10 bill to the bartender with a whispered, "See that that gentleman, if I may speak loosely, does not leave until I return. Feed him drinks and put it on my tab, if absolutely necessary." I never failed to carry with me those simple ingredients I used to call up a Zazzle, and in a very few minutes he was sitting on the bed lamp in my room, suffused with his usual tiny pink glow. He said censoriously in his piping little voice, "You interrupted me when I was in the midst of constructing a Pasmarazzo, with which I fully expected to win the heart of a lovely Samini." "I regret that, Azazel," I said, hoping he would not delay me by describing the nature of the Pasmarazzo or the charms of the Samini, for neither of which I cared the paring of a fingernail. "But I have here a possible emergency of the most extreme sort."
"You always say that," he said discontentedly.
Hastily, I outlined the situation, and I must say he grasped it at once. He is very good that way, never requiring long explanations. My own belief is that he piques at my mind, although he always assures me that he considers my thoughts inviolable. Still, how far can you trust a 2-centimeter demon, who, by his own admission, is constantly trying to overreach lovely Samini, whatever they are, by the most dishonorable ruses? Besides, I'm not sure whether he says he considers my thoughts inviolable or insufferable, but that is neither here nor there.
"Where is this human being you speak of?"
he squeaked. "In the lounge. It is located—"
"Don't bother. I shall follow the aura of moral decay. I think I have it. How do I identify the human being?"
"Sandy hair, pale eyes—"
"No, no. His mind."
"A fanatic."
"Ah, you might have said so at once. I have him, and I see I shall require a thorough steam bath when I return home. He is worse than you are."
"Never mind that. Is he telling the truth?"
"About the Caesar? Which, by the way, is a clever conceit."
"Yes."
"Well, that is a difficult question. As I often say to a friend of mine who considers himself a great spiritual leader, what is truth?" "I'll tell you this. He considers it the truth. He believes it. What a human being believes, however, no matter with what ardor, is not necessarily objective truth. You have probably caught a hint of this in the course of your life."
"I have. But is there no way you can distinguish between belief that stems from objective truth and belief that does not?"
"In intelligent entities, certainly. In human beings, no. But apparently you consider this man an enormous danger. I can rearrange some of the molecules of his brain, and he will then be dead."
"No, no," I said. "It may be a silly weakness on my part, but I do object to murder. Couldn't you rearrange molecules in such a way that he will lose all memory of the Caesar?" Azazel sighed in a thin, wheezing way.
"This is really much more difficult. Those molecules are heavy, and they stick together. Really, why not a clean disruption?"
"I insist," I said.
"Oh, very well," said Azazel sullenly.
And then he went through a whole litany of puffing and panting designed to show me how hard he was working. Finally, he said,
"It's done."
"Good. Wait here, please. I just want to check it out, and then I'll be right back." I rushed down hastily, and Hannibal West was still sitting where I had left him. The bartender winked at me as I passed.
"No drinks necessary, sir,"
said that worthy person, and I gave him $5 more. West looked up cheerfully.
There you are.
Yes, indeed, I said. Very penetrating of you to notice that. I have the solution of the problem of the Caesar.
The problem of the what?
He asked, clearly puzzled. That object you discovered in the course of your speleological explorations.
What are speleological explorations?
Your investigations of caves.
Sir, said West, frowning, I have never been in a cave in my life. Are you mad?
No, but I have just remembered an important meeting. Farewell, sir. Probably we shall never meet again. I hastened back to the room, panting a little, and found Azazel humming to himself some tune favored by the entities of his world. Really, their taste in what they call music is atrocious. His memory is gone, I said, and, I hope, permanently.
Of course, said Azazel. The next step now is to consider the Caesar itself. Its structure must be very neatly and precisely organized if it can actually magnify sound at the expense of Earth's internal heat. No doubt a tiny disruption at some key point, something that may be within my mighty powers, could wipe out all Caesar activity. Exactly where is it located?
I stared at him, thunderstruck. How should I know? I said. He stared at me, probably thunderstruck also, but I can never make out the expressions on his tiny face.
Do you mean to say you had me wipe out his memory before you obtained that vital piece of information?
It never occurred to me, I said.
But if the Caesar exists, if his belief was based on objective truth, someone else may stumble upon it, or a large animal might, or a meteorite might strike it, and at any moment, day or night, all life on Earth may be destroyed.
Good Lord, I muttered. Apparently my distress moved him, for he said,
Come, come, my friend, look at the bright side. The worst that might happen is that human beings will all be wiped out. Just human beings. It's not as though they're people.
Having completed his tale, George said despondently, And there you are. I have to live with the knowledge that the world may come to an end at any moment. Nonsense, I said heartily. Even if you've told me the truth about this Hannibal West, which, if you will pardon me, is by no means assured, he may have been having a sick fantasy. George looked haughtily down his nose at me for a moment, then said, I would not have your unlovely tendency towards skepticism for all the loveliest Samini on Azazel's native world. How do you explain this? He withdrew a small clipping from his wallet. It was from yesterday's New York Times and was headed A Dim Rumble. It told of a dim rumble that was perturbing the inhabitants of Grenoble, France. One explanation, George, I said, is that you saw this article and made up the whole story to suit. For a moment, George looked as though he would explode with indignation. But when I picked up the rather substantial check that the waitress had placed between us, softer feelings overcame him, and we shook hands on parting, amiably enough. And yet, I must admit I haven't slept well since. I keep sitting up at about 2:30 a.m., listening for the dim rumble I could swear had roused me from sleep. Saving Humanity. My friend George, sighing lugubriously, said to me one evening, I have a friend who is a klutz. I nodded wisely. Birds of a feather, I said. George gazed at me in astonishment. What have feathers to do with it? You have the most remarkable ability to skid away from a subject. It is the result, I suppose, of your thoroughly inadequate intellect, which I mention in pity and not as reproof. Well, well, I said, let that be as it may. When you refer to your friend the klutz, are you speaking of Azazel? Azazel was the 2-centimeter demon, or extraterrestrial being, take your pick, concerning whom George talks constantly, ceasing only in response to a direct question. Freezingly, he said, Azazel is not a subject for conversation, and I do not understand how you come to have heard of him. I happened to be within a mile of you one day, I said. George paid no attention, but said, I first came across the un-euphonious word Klutz, in fact, through a conversation with my friend Menander Block. You have never met him, I'm afraid, for he is a university man, and therefore rather selective in his friendships, for which one, observing you, can scarcely blame him. The word Klutz, he told me, referred to an awkward, clumsy person. "And that's me," he said. "It comes from a Yiddish word that, taken literally, means a piece of wood, a log, a block. And, of course, my name, as you will note, is Block." He heaved an enormous sigh. "And yet I am not a klutz in the strict meaning of the word. There is nothing wooden, loggish, or blockish about me. I dance as lightly as a zephyr and as gracefully as a dragonfly. I am sylph-like in every motion, and numerous young women could testify, if I thought it safe to allow them to do so, of my skill as a disciple of the amatory art. It is rather that I am a klutz at long distance. Without being myself affected, everything about me becomes klutzish. The very universe itself seems to trip over its own cosmic feet. I suppose if you want to mix languages and combine Greek with Yiddish, I am a teleklutz." "How long has this been going on, Menander?" I asked. "All my life. But, of course, it was only as an adult that I realized this peculiar quality I possess. While still a youth, I simply assumed that what happened to me was the normal state of affairs." "Have you discussed this with anyone?" "Of course not, George, old fellow. I would be considered mad. Can you see a psychoanalyst, for instance, confronting the phenomenon of teleklutzism? He would have me in the funny house halfway through my first session, and write a paper on his discovery of a new psychosis, and probably become a millionaire as a result. I'm not going to the booby hatch just to enrich some psychomedical leech. I cannot tell anyone this." "Then why are you telling me this, Menander?" "Because, on the other hand, it seems to me I must tell someone if I am to remain functional. As it happens, you are the least someone I know." I did not follow his reasoning there, but I could see that I was about to be subjected once again to the unwanted confidences of my friends. It was the price, I well knew, of the fact that I was proverbial for my understanding, sympathy, and most of all for my close-mouthed reticence. No secret placed in my keeping would ever reach the ears of anyone else. I make an exception in your case, of course, since it is well known that you have an attention span of 5 seconds and a memory span of rather less. I signaled for another drink and indicated, by a certain arcane sign that I alone know, that it was to be placed on Menander's tab. A laborer, after all, is worthy of his hire. I said, "Just how does this teleklutzism manifest itself, Menander?" "In its simplest form, and in the manner that was first brought to my attention, it shows up in the peculiar weather that accompanies my travels. I do not travel very much, and when I do, I go by car. And when I do that, it rains. It doesn't matter what the weather forecast is. It doesn't matter how brightly the sun is shining when I start out. The clouds gather, grow darker, and it begins to drizzle and then to pour. When my teleklutzism is in particular fettle, the temperature drops and we have an ice storm. Of course, I am careful not to be foolish. I refuse to drive into New England until March is safely over. Last spring, I drove to Boston on April 6th, which promptly had the first April blizzard in the history of the Boston Weather Bureau. I once drove to Williamsburg, Virginia, on March 28th, assuming that I might be allowed a few days of grace, considering that I was penetrating Dixie. Ha! Williamsburg had 9 inches of snow that day, and the natives were trying to rub some of it between their fingers and were asking each other what the white stuff was. I have often thought that if we imagined the universe to be under the personal direction of God, we might picture Gabriel rushing into the divine presence to cry out, 'Holy One, two galaxies are about to collide in an unimaginably enormous catastrophe.' And God would answer, 'Don't bother me now, Gabriel. I'm busy making it rain on Menander.'" I said, "You might make the best of the situation, Menander. Why not sell your services for fabulous sums as a drought breaker?" "I have thought of that. But the mere thought dries up any rain that might occur during my travels. Besides, if the rain came when it was needed, it would probably produce a flood. And it's not only rain or traffic jams or the disappearance of landmarks. There are a myriad other things. Expensive objects break spontaneously in my presence, or are dropped by others through no fault attributable to myself. There is an advanced particle accelerator in operation in Batavia, Illinois. One day, an enormously important experiment was ruined because of the failure of its vacuum, a completely unexplained failure. Only I knew, the next day, that is, when I read of the incident in the paper, that at the very moment of failure, I happened to be passing the outskirts of Batavia in a bus. It was raining, of course. At this very moment, old fellow, some of the fine 5-day-old wine in the cellars of this fine establishment, being aged in the plastic, is turning sour. Someone brushing past this table at this moment will, when he arrives home, find that the pipes in his cellar have burst at the precise moment he passed me. Except that he won't know that he passed me at that precise moment, and that the passage was the cause. And so it will be with scores of accidents, supposed accidents, that is. I felt sorry for my young friend, and my blood froze at the thought that I was sitting next to him, and that at my cozy digs unimaginable catastrophes might be taking place. I said, "You are, in short, a jinx." Menander threw his head back and stared down his nose at me in a most unpleasant way. "Jinx," he said, "is the common term. Teleklutz is the scientific one." "Well, then, jinx or teleklutz, suppose I told you I could perhaps remove this curse from you."
"Curse is right," Menander said gloomily.
"I have often thought that at the time of my birth, an ill-natured fairy, irked at not having been invited to the christening..." "Are you trying to tell me you can cancel curses because you are a good fairy?"
"I am not any kind of fairy," I said severely. "Just suppose I can remove this condition of yours."
"How on earth could you do that?"
"Not exactly on earth," I said. "But how about it?"
"What do you get out of it?"
he asked suspiciously. "The heartwarming feeling of having helped save a friend from a horrible life." Menander thought about it and then shook his head firmly.
"That's not enough."
"Of course, if you want to offer me some small sum..."
"No, no, I wouldn't think of insulting you that way. Offer a sum of money to a friend? Place a fiscal value on friendship? How could you think that of me, George? What I meant was that removing my teleklutzism isn't enough. You must do more than that."
"How can one do more?"
"Consider. Through my life, I have been responsible for anything from inconvenience to catastrophe to perhaps millions of innocent people. Even if I brought no ill fortune to a single person from this moment on, the evil I have done thus far, even though none of it was voluntary or in any way to be considered my fault, is more than I can bear. I must have something that will cancel it all out."
"Like what?"
"I must be in a position to save humanity."
"Save humanity?
What else can possibly balance the immeasurable damage I have done? George, I insist. If you are going to remove my curse, replace it with the ability to save humanity in some great crisis."
"I'm not sure that I can."
"Try, George. Don't shy away at this crisis. If you're going to do a job, do it well, I always say. Think of humanity, old friend."
"Wait a moment," I said, alarmed. "You're putting this whole thing on my shoulders."
"Of course I am, George," Menander said warmly. "Broad shoulders, good shoulders, made to bear burdens. Go home, George, and arrange to remove this curse from me. A grateful humanity will shower you with blessings. Except, of course, that they will never hear of it, for I will tell no one. Your good deeds are not to be shamed by exposure. And rely on me, I will never expose them."
There is something wonderful about unselfish friendship that can be duplicated by nothing else on earth. I rose at once to get to my task, and left so quickly that I neglected to pay my half of the dinner bill. Fortunately, Menander did not notice this till I was safely out of the restaurant. I had some trouble getting in touch with Azazel, and when I did, he didn't seem good-natured about it at all. His 2-centimeter-tall body was wrapped in a pinkish glow, and in his piping voice he said,
"Has it occurred to you that I might be showering?"
And indeed, there was a very faint smell of ammonia about him. I said humbly,
This is a rather enormous emergency, O mighty one for whom words are insufficient.
Well, then, tell me. But mind, don't take all day about it.
Certainly, I said, and outlined the matter with admirable conciseness.
Said Azazel. For once you have presented me with an interesting problem.
I have? Do you mean there is indeed such a thing as teleclotsism?
Oh, yes. You see, quantum mechanics makes it quite clear that the properties of the universe depend, to a certain extent, on the observer. Just as the universe affects the observer affects the universe. Some observers affect the universe adversely, or at least adversely with respect to some other observers. Thus, one observer may accelerate the supernovadom of some star, which would irritate other observers who may find themselves uncomfortably close to that star at the time.
I see. Well, can you help my friend Menander and remove this quantum observational effect of his?
Oh, of course. Simple. It will take 10 seconds, and then I can return to my shower, and to the right of La Scorati I will undertake with 2 samini of unimaginable loveliness.
Wait, that's not enough.
Don't be silly. 2 samini are quite enough. Only a lecher would want 3.
I mean, removing the teleclutsism isn't enough. Menander also wants to be in a position to save humanity. For a minute, I thought Azazel was going to forget our long friendship and all I had done for him in the way of supplying him with interesting problems that probably improved his mind and his magical abilities. I did not understand all he said, for most of the words were in his own language, but they sounded very much like saws scraping along rusty nails. Finally, having cooled down to a dim red heat, he said,
"Now how am I going to do that?"
"Is anything too much for the apostle of incredibility?"
"You bet. But let's see."
He thought for a while and burst out,
"But who in the universe would want to save humanity? Where's the worth in doing that? You stink up this whole section." Well, I think it can be done."
It didn't take 10 seconds. It took half an hour, and a very uncomfortable half hour it was, too, with Azazel groaning part of the time, and the rest of the time stopping to wonder whether the Samini were going to wait for him. He was done eventually, and of course it meant I would have to test out the matter on Menander Block. When I next saw Menander, I said, "You're cured." He stared at me hostily.
"Do you know that you stuck me with the dinner check the other night?"
"Surely a minor point compared with the fact that you're cured."
"I don't feel cured."
"Well, come, let's take a drive together. You take the wheel."
"It looks cloudy already. Some cure."
"Drive. What have we to lose?" He backed the car out of his garage. A man passing by on the other side of the street did not trip over an overloaded garbage can. Menander drove down the street. The light did not turn red as he approached, and 2 cars skidding toward each other at the intersection next but one missed each other by a comfortable margin. By the time he was at the bridge, the clouds had thinned out, and a warm sun was shining down upon the car. It was not in his eyes. When we finally got home, he was weeping unashamedly, and I parked the car for him. I scraped it slightly, but it was not I that had had my teleclutsism cured. At that, it might have been worse. I might have scraped my own car. For the next few days, he was seeking me out constantly. I was the only one, after all, who could understand the miracle that had taken place. He would say, "I went to a dance, and not one couple tripped over each other's feet and fell down and broke a collarbone or two. I could dance sylph-like with utter abandon, and my partner never got sick to her stomach, even though she had eaten most unwisely." Or, "At work, they were installing a new air conditioning unit, and not once did it fall upon a workman's toes, breaking them permanently." Or even, "I visited a friend in a hospital, something I once wouldn't have dreamed of doing, and in not one of the rooms that I passed did the intravenous needle pop out of a vein, nor did a single hypodermic miss its appropriate target." Sometimes he would ask me brokenly, "Are you sure that I will have a chance to save humanity?" "Absolutely," I would say. "That's part of the cure." But then one day he came to me, and there was a frown on his face.
"Listen,"
he said. I just went to the bank to ask a question about my bank balance, which is a little lower than it should be because of the way you managed to get out of restaurants before the bill shows up, and I couldn't get an answer because the computer went down just as I walked in. Everyone was puzzled. Is the cure wearing off? It can't do that, I said. Maybe it had nothing to do with you. There might be some other teleklutz around who hasn't been cured. Maybe he happened to walk in just as you did. But that wasn't it. The bank's computer went down on two other occasions when he tried to check his bank balance. His nervousness over the paltry sums I had neglected to take care of was quite nauseating in a grown man. Finally, when the computer at his firm went down when he walked past the room in which it was housed, he came to me in what I can only describe as panic.
"It's back, I tell you, it's back," he screamed. "I can't take it this time. Now that I'm accustomed to normality, I can't go back to my old life. I'll have to kill myself."
"No, no, Menander, that's going too far." He seemed to check himself at the edge of another scream and thought over my sensible remark.
"You're right," he said. "That is going too far. Suppose I kill you instead. After all, no one will miss you, and it will make me feel a little better."
I saw his point, but only to a slight extent. I said, "Before you do anything at all, let me check this out. Be patient, Menander. After all, so far it's only happened with computers, and who cares about computers?" I left quickly before he could ask me how he was supposed to get an instantaneous bank balance if computers were always going down at his approach. He was really a monomaniac on the subject. So was Azazel on another subject. It seems that this time he was actually involved in whatever he was doing with the two Samini, and he was still turning somersaults when he arrived. To this day, I don't know what the somersaults had to do with it. I don't think he ever actually cooled down, but he did manage to explain to me what happened, and then I was faced with having to explain it to Menander. I insisted on meeting him in the park. I chose a fairly crowded section, since I would have to rely on instant rescue if he should lose his head figuratively and try to make me lose mine literally. I said, "Menander, your teleklutzism still works, but only for computers. Only for computers. You have my word on that. You are cured for everything else forever."
"Well, then, cure me for computers."
"As it happens, Menander, that can't be done. You are not cured for computers, and forever." I rather whispered the last word, but he heard me.
"Why? What kind of a harebrained, idiotic, malapropistic, omniklutzistic rear end of a diseased Bactrian camel are you?"
"You make it sound as though there are many kinds, Menander, which doesn't make sense. Don't you understand that you wanted to save the world, and that's why it happened?"
"No, I don't understand. Explain it to me and take your time. You have 15 seconds.
"Be reasonable. Humanity is facing a computer explosion. Computers are going to become rapidly more versatile, more capable, and more intelligent. Human beings are going to be ever more dependent upon them. Eventually, a computer will be built that will take over the world and leave humanity with nothing to do. It may then well decide to wipe out humanity as unnecessary. Of course, we tell ourselves smugly that we can always pull the plug, but you know we won't be able to do that. A computer smart enough to do the work of the world without us will be able to defend its own plug, and for that matter, find its own electricity. It will be unbeatable, and humanity will be doomed. And that, my friend, is where you come in. You will be brought into its presence, or perhaps you will only arrange to pass within a few miles of it, and it will instantly break down, and humanity will be saved. Humanity will be saved. Think of it. Think of it." Menander thought of it. He didn't look happy. He said,
"But meanwhile, I can't come near computers."
"Well, the computer klutzism had to be nailed down and made absolutely permanent, so we could be sure that when the time came, nothing would go wrong. That the computer would not somehow defend itself against you. It's the price you pay for this great gift of salvation that you yourself asked for, and for which you will be honored through all future history."
"Yes?" he said. "And when is this salvation to take place?"
I said, "According to Azaz, my sources, it should take place in 60 years or so, But look at it this way. Now you know that you will live to be at least 90 years old.
And meanwhile,
said Menander in a loud voice, oblivious to the way people nearby turned to stare at us,
meanwhile, the world will grow more and more computerized, and I will be unable to get near more and more places. I'll be unable to do more and more things, and will be in a total prison of my own making.
But in the end, you will save humanity. That's what you wanted. Menander shrieked,
to hell with humanity!
Rose and hurled himself at me. I managed to get away, but only because there were people about who seized the poor fellow. Today, Menander is in deep analysis with a Freudian psychiatrist of the most determined description. It will surely cost him a fortune, and will, of course, do him no good whatever. George, having finished his story, gazed into his pot of beer, for which I knew I would have to pay. He said, "There's a moral to this story, you know." "What is it?" "People just don't have any gratitude." A matter of principle. George stared somberly into his glass, which contained my drink, in the sense that I would surely be paying for it, and said, "It is only a matter of principle that makes me a poor man today." He then fetched a huge sigh up from the region of his umbilicus and said, "In mentioning principle, I must, of course, apologize for using a term of which you are not cognizant, except perhaps as the title of an official at the grade school from which you nearly graduated. As a matter of fact, I am myself a man of principle." "Really?" I said. "I presume you have been granted this character trait by Azazel only 2 minutes ago, for you had never exhibited it to anyone's knowledge before then." George looked at me in an aggrieved manner. Azazel is the 2-centimeter demon who possesses stunning magical powers, and only George is able to conjure him up at will. He said, "I cannot imagine where you have heard of Azazel." "It's a complete mystery to me, too," I said agreeably. "Or would be if it weren't your sole subject of conversation these days." "Don't be ridiculous," said George. "I never mention him." "Gottlieb Jones," said George, "was a man of principle, too. You might think that an utter impossibility, considering that his occupation was that of an advertising copywriter, but he rose superior to his vile calling with an ardor it was most attractive to watch. Many times he would say to me, over a friendly hamburger and dish of French fries, 'George, words cannot describe the horror of the job I have, or the despair that fills me at the thought that I must find persuasive ways of selling products that every instinct tells me human beings are better off without. Only yesterday I had to help sell a new variety of insect repellent, which, by test, has mosquitoes emitting supersonic screams of delight as they flock to it from miles around. Don't be mosquito bait, my slogan reads. Use skeeter hate.' 'Skeeter hate?' I repeated, shuddering strongly. Gottlieb covered his eyes with one hand. I'm sure he would have used both had he not been shoveling French fries into his mouth with the other. 'I live with this shame, George, and sooner or later I must leave the job. It violates my principles of business ethics and my writing ideals, and I am a man of principle.' I said courteously, 'It does bring you $50,000 a year, Gottlieb, and you do have a young and beautiful wife, plus an infant child to support.'
'Money,' said Gottlieb violently, 'is dross. It is the worthless bribe for which a man sells his soul. I repudiate it, George. I cast it from me with scorn. I will have nothing to do with it.'
'But, Gottlieb, surely you are doing no such thing. You accept your salary, do you not?' I will admit that for an uncomfortable moment, I thought of a penniless Gottlieb and the number of lunches his virtue would make it impossible for him to buy the two of us.
'Well, yes, I do. My dear wife Marilyn has a disconcerting way of introducing her household allowance into conversations of an otherwise purely intellectual sort, to say nothing of her idle references to various purchases she foolishly makes at clothing stores and appliance shops. This does have a constraining influence on my plans of action. As for young Gottlieb Jr., who is now nearly 6 months old, he is not quite ready to understand the utter unimportance of money, though I will do him the justice of admitting that he has never yet actually asked me for any.' He sighed, and I sighed with him.
I had frequently heard of the uncooperative nature of wives and children where finances are concerned, and it is, of course, the chief reason I have remained uncommitted in this respect through a long lifetime, during which my ineffable charm has caused me to be pursued ardently by a variety of beautiful women. Gottlieb Jones unwittingly interrupted several pleasant reminiscences in which I was harmlessly indulging myself by saying, "Do you know my secret dream, George?" And for a moment he had so lubricous a gleam in his eyes that I started in mild alarm, thinking he had somehow read my mind. He added, however, "It is my dream to be a novelist, to write trenchant exposés of the quivering depths of the human soul, to hold up before a humanity that is at once shuddering and delighted the glorious complexities of the human condition, to write my name in large indelible letters across the face of classic literature, and to march down the generations in the glorious company of men and women such as Aeschylus, Shakespeare, and Ellison." We had finished our meal, and I waited tensely for the check, judging to a nicety the moment when I would allow my attention to be distracted. The waiter, weighing the matter with the keen perception inseparable from his profession, handed it to Gottlieb. I relaxed and said, "Consider, my dear Gottlieb, the appalling consequences that might follow. I have read but recently, in a newspaper of the highest reliability which a gentleman near me happened to be holding, that there are 35,000 published novelists in the United States, that of these, but 700 make a living of their craft, and that 50, only 50, my friend, are rich. In comparison with this, your present salary..." "Bah!" said Gottlieb. "It is a matter of little moment to me whether I make money or not. Just so I gain immortality and bestow a priceless gift of insight and understanding to all future generations. I could easily bear the discomfort of having Marilyn take a job as waitress or bus driver, or some other undemanding position. I am quite certain she would, or should, consider it a privilege to work by day and care for Gottlieb Jr. by night, so that my artistry might have full play. Only..." He paused. "Only..." I said encouragingly. "Well, I don't know why it is, George," he said, a rather petulant note entering his voice, "but there is a trifle that stands in the way. I don't seem to be able quite to do it. My brain teems with ideas of tremendous moment. Scenes, scraps of dialogue, situations of extraordinary vitality tumble through my mind constantly. It is only the very unimportant matter of actually placing it all into appropriate words that seems to elude me. It must be a minor problem, for every incompetent scrivener, such as that friend of yours with the peculiar name, seems to be at no loss for a way of turning out books by the hundred, and yet I cannot quite grasp the trick." He surely must have meant you, my dear fellow, since the phrase "incompetent scrivener" seems so apt. I would have defended you, of course, but I felt that that would be a losing proposition. "Surely," I said, "you can't have tried hard enough." "Have I not? I have hundreds of sheets of paper, each containing the first paragraph of a marvelous novel. The first paragraph and no more. Hundreds of different first paragraphs for hundreds of different novels. It is the second paragraph that, in every case, is the stumbling block." A brilliant idea struck me. But I was not surprised. My mind welters constantly in brilliant ideas. "Gottlieb," I said, "I can solve this problem for you. I can make you a novelist. I can make you rich." He looked at me with an unlovely gleam of skepticism. "You can?" he said, with a most unflattering emphasis on the pronoun. We had risen and left the restaurant. I noted that Gottlieb had forgotten to leave a tip, but felt it to be scarcely politic for me to mention the fact, as he might have then made the appalling suggestion, that I take care of it. "My friend," I said, "I have the secret of the second paragraph, and therefore can make you rich and famous."
"Ha! What is the secret?"
I said delicately, and here we come to the brilliant idea that had struck me, "Gottlieb, a laborer is worthy of his hire." Gottlieb laughed shortly.
"My confidence in you is such, George, that I have no fear in stating that if you can make me a rich and famous novelist, you can have half my earnings. After business expenses are deducted, of course."
I said even more delicately, I know you to be a man of principle, Gottlieb, so that your bare word will hold you to an agreement as though you were bound with hoops of the finest alloy steel. But just for a laugh, would you be willing to put that statement into written form and have it signed and, just to make the laugh even heartier, notarized? We can each have a copy. That little transaction took up only half an hour of time, since it involved only a notary public who was also a typist and a friend of mine. I put my copy of the precious paper carefully into my wallet and said, "I cannot give you the secret immediately, but as soon as I have arranged matters, I will let you know. You can then try to write a novel, and you will find that you will have no trouble with the second paragraph, or the 2002nd. Of course, you will not owe me anything until the first advance, a very large one, I'll be bound, comes in." "You'd better believe it," said Gottlieb nastily. I went through the ritual that called up Azazel that very evening. He is only 2 centimeters tall and is a personage of no account on his own world. That is the only reason he is willing to help me out in various trivial ways. It makes him feel important. Of course, I can never persuade him to do anything that will serve, in some direct fashion, to make me rich. The little creature insists that this would be an unacceptable commercialization of his art. Nor does he seem convinced by my assurance that anything he will do for me will be used in an utterly selfless way for the good of the world. When I said that, he made a queer sound, the significance of which I did not understand, and which he said he had learned from a native of the Bronx. It was for that reason that I did not explain the nature of my agreement with Gottlieb Jones. It would not be Azazel who would be making me rich. It would be Gottlieb who would be doing so, after Azazel had made him rich. But I despaired of making Azazel understand the nice distinction involved. Azazel was, as usual, irritated by having been called up. His tiny head was decorated with what looked like minute fronds of seaweed, and it appeared from his somewhat incoherent account that he had been in the midst of an academic ceremony in which some honor or other was being conferred upon him. Being of no real account on his own world, as I said earlier, he had the tendency to attach far too much importance to such an event, and was bitter in his comments. I shrugged it off. "You can, after all," I said, "take care of my trifling request, and then return to the exact moment at which you left. No one will even know you were gone." He grumbled a little, but had to admit that I was right, so that the air in his immediate vicinity ceased crackling with miniature lightning.
"What do you want, then?" he demanded.
I explained.
Azazel said, "His profession is that of the communication of ideas, is that it? The translation of ideas into words, as in the case of your friend with the peculiar name?"
"That is it. But he wishes to do it with increased efficiency, and to please those he deals with, so that he achieves much acclaim. And wealth, too, but he wants that only as tangible evidence of the acclaim, for he despises money in itself."
"I understand. We have wordsmiths on our world, too, and one and all value only the acclaim and would not accept the smallest unit of currency, were it not that they must have it as tangible evidence of the acclaim."
I laughed indulgently. "A foible of the profession. You and I are fortunate to be above such things."
"Well," said Azazel, "I can't be here for the rest of the year, can I, or I'll have trouble pinpointing the precise time of my return. Is this friend of yours within mental reach?"
We had trouble finding him, even though I pointed out the location of his advertising firm on a map and gave my usual eloquent and accurate description of the man, but I don't want to bore you with irrelevant detail. Gottlieb was eventually found, and after a brief study, Azazel said,
"A peculiar mind of the type universal among your unpleasant species. Gummy, yet fragile. I see the wordsmith circuit, and it is knotted and bumpy, which makes it no surprise that he is having trouble. I can remove the obstructing bit, but that could endanger the stability of his mind. I think not, if I am skillful enough, but there is always the chance of accident. Do you suppose he would be willing to take the risk?"
"Oh, undoubtedly," I said. "He is intent on fame and on serving the world with his art. He wouldn't hesitate to take the risk at all."
"Yes, but you are a devoted friend of his, I gather. He may be blinded by his ambition and his desire to do good, but you may see more clearly. Are you willing to have him take the chance?"
My only aim, I said, is to bring him happiness. Go ahead, and hack away as carefully as you can. And if things go wrong, well, it will have been in a good cause. And it was, of course, since if things went right, I would get half of the financial consequences. And so the deed was done. Azazel made heavy weather about it, as he always did, and lay there panting for a while, and muttering something about unreasonable requests. But I told him to think of the happiness he was bringing millions of people, and urged him to avoid the unendearing quality of self-love. Much improved by my edifying words, he left in order to see to the completion of whatever trifling honor had come his way. It was about a week later that I sought out Gottlieb Jones. I had made no effort to see him sooner, for I felt it might take him some small period of time to adjust to his new brain. Besides, I preferred to wait and inquire about him indirectly just at first, to see if he had been brain damaged in any way in the process. If he had, I would have seen no point in the meeting. My loss, and his too, I suppose, would make a meeting too poignant. I heard nothing untoward about him, and certainly he seemed quite normal when I met him coming out of the building that housed his firm. I noted at once the air of settled melancholy about him. I paid that little attention, for writers, I have long noticed, are prone to melancholy. It is something about the profession, I believe. The constant contact with editors, perhaps. "Ah, George," he said listlessly. "Gottlieb," I said. "How good to see you. You are looking more handsome than ever." Actually, like all writers, he is quite ugly, but one must be polite. "Have you tried to write a novel lately?" "No, I haven't." Then, as though he had suddenly remembered, he said, "Why, are you ready to give me that secret of yours concerning the second paragraph?" I was delighted that he remembered, for that was another indication that his brain was as sharp as it had ever been. I said, "But that's all done, my dear fellow. There was no need for me to explain anything. I have more subtle methods than that. You need merely go home and sit down at your typewriter, and you will find yourself writing like an angel. Rest assured that your troubles are over, and that novels will tumble smoothly out of your typewriter. Write 2 chapters and an outline of the rest, and I am absolutely certain that any publisher you show it to will shout with joy and make out a huge check, every cent of which will be half yours." "Ha!" snorted Gottlieb. "My assurance," I said, placing my hand upon my heart, which, as you know, is large enough, in a figurative sense, to fill my entire thoracic cavity. "In fact, I feel it to be entirely safe for you to quit this foul job of yours in order that it might in no way contaminate the pure material that will now be emerging from your typewriter. You have but to try, Gottlieb, and you will agree that I have more than earned my half."
"You mean you want me to quit my job?"
"Exactly."
"I can't do it."
"Certainly you can. Turn your back on this ignoble position. Spurn the stultifying task of commercial puffery." "I tell you, I can't quit. I've just been fired."
"Fired?"
"Yes, and with expressions of lack of admiration which were of a type that I have no intention of ever forgiving." We turned to walk toward the small and inexpensive place where we usually dined. "What happened?" I asked. He told me morosely over a pastrami sandwich. He said, "I was writing copy for a room freshener, and I was overwhelmed by the enforced gentility of it all. It was all we could do to use the word odor. Suddenly, I just want to speak my mind. If we were going to promote this damned garbage, why not do it right? So I put at the head of my finicky copy, 'Shrink the stink,' and at the bottom, 'Quench the stench,' and then had it messengered over to the account without bothering to consult anybody. After it was messengered, though, I thought, 'Why not?' and sent a memo to my boss, who had a very loud and very instant apoplectic fit. He called me in and told me I was fired, along with some very harsh words that I knew he had never learned at his mother's knee, unless she was a very unusual mother. So here I am, out of a job." He looked up at me with a hostile scowl. "I suppose you'll tell me this is your doing." I said, "Of course it is. You did what you subconsciously knew was right. You deliberately had yourself fired so you could spend all your time at your true art. Gottlieb, my friend, go home now. Write your novel and make sure you get no less than $100,000 advance. Since there will be no business expenses to speak of, except a few pennies for paper, you will not have to deduct anything and can keep $50,000. He said, "You're crazy." "I am confident," I said, "and to prove it, I will pay for the lunch." "You are crazy," he said in an awed kind of voice, and actually left me to pay the bill, though he must have known that my offer was merely a rhetorical device. I phoned him the next night. Ordinarily, I would have waited longer. I would not have wanted to rush him. Still, I now had a financial investment in him. Lunch had cost me $11, to say nothing of a quarter tip, and I was naturally restless. You can understand that. "Gottlieb," I said, "how is the novel going?" "Fine," he said absently. "No problem. I knocked off 20 pages, and very good stuff, too." Yet he sounded casual, as though it was something else on his mind. I said, "Why aren't you jumping for joy?" "Over the novel? Don't be silly. Feinberg, Salzburg, and Rosenberg called." "Your advertising, your ex-advertising firm?" "Yes. Not all of them, of course, just Mr. Feinberg himself. He wants me back." "I trust, Gottlieb, you told him exactly how far up..." But Gottlieb interrupted me. "Apparently," he said, "the air freshener account went wild over my copy. They wanted to use it, and they wanted to commission a whole group of ads, for TV as well as for the printed media. And they wanted only the writer of that first ad to organize the campaign. They said that what I had done had been bold and hard-hitting, and that it perfectly suited the decade of the 80s. They said they wanted to produce advertising that was unprecedentedly forceful, and for that, they needed me. Naturally, I said I would consider it." "That's a mistake, Gottlieb. I ought to be able to hit them for a raise, a substantial one. I have not forgotten the cruel things Feinberg said when he kicked me out, some in Yiddish." "Money is dross, Gottlieb." "Of course, George, but I want to see how much dross is involved." I wasn't very worried. I knew how the task of writing advertising copy grated on Gottlieb's sensitive soul, and I knew how attractive would be the ease with which he could write a novel. It was only necessary to wait, and, to coin a phrase, let nature take its course. But then the air freshener ads came out, and they made an instant hit with the public. "Quench the stench" became a byword with the youth of America, and each use was, willy-nilly, a plug for the product. I imagine that you yourself remember that fad, but of course you do, for I understand rejection slips containing the phrase became de rigueur among the periodicals for which you try to write, and you must have experienced it many times. Other ads of the sort came out and were just as successful. And suddenly I understood. Azazel had arranged to give Gottlieb the mindset that made it possible for him to please the public with his writing. But being small and of no account, he had been unable to fine-tune the mind in order to make the gift applicable to novels only. It might well be that Azazel did not even know what a novel was. Well, did it matter? I can't say that Gottlieb was exactly pleased when he came home and found me at his doorstep, but he was not so entirely lost to shame as to refuse to invite me in. In fact, it was with some satisfaction that I realized he could not fail to invite me to dinner, though he sought, deliberately, I think, to destroy that pleasure by having me hold Gottlieb Jr. for a lengthy period of time. It was a fearful experience. Afterward, when we were alone in his dining room, I said, "And how much dross are you making, Gottlieb?" He looked at me reproachfully. "Don't call it dross, George. It's disrespectful. $50,000 a year, I admit, is dross. But $100,000 a year, plus some very satisfactory perks, is financial status. What's more, I will soon establish my own firm and become a multimillionaire, at which level money becomes virtue, or power, which is the same thing, of course. With my power, for instance, I will be able to drive Feinberg out of business. That will teach him to address me in terms that no gentleman should use to another. Do you happen to know what Schmendrick means, by the way, George?" I couldn't help him there. I am conversant with a number of languages, but Urdu is not one of them. I said, "Then you have grown rich, and plan to grow far richer." "In that case, Gottlieb, May I point out that this happened only after I agreed to make you rich, at which time you, in turn, promised to give me half your earnings? Gottlieb's eyebrows drew together in a frown. Did you? Did I? Why, yes. I admit it is the sort of thing that is very easy to forget, but fortunately it was all placed in writing, in return for services rendered, signed, notarized, all that sort of thing. And I happen to have a photocopy of the agreement with me. Ah, may I see it, then? Certainly. But may I stress that it is merely a photocopy, so that if you should accidentally happen to tear it into little pieces in your eagerness to examine it closely, I will still have the original in my possession. A wise move, George, but do not fear. If all is as you say, not one jot nor tittle, not even a penny, will be withheld from you. I am a man of principle, and I honor all agreements to the letter. I gave him the photocopy, and he studied it carefully. Ah, yes, he said. I do remember, of course. There's only one little point. What? I asked. Well, here on this paper it refers to my earnings as a novelist. I am not a novelist, George. You intended to be, and you can be one any time you sit down at the typewriter. But I no longer intend to be, George, and I do not expect to sit down at the typewriter. But great novels will mean immortal fame. What can your idiotic slogans bring you? Lots and lots of money, George, plus a huge firm which I will own, and which will employ many miserable copywriters whose very lives I will hold in the hollow of my hand. Did Tolstoy ever have that? Does Del Rey? I couldn't believe it. And after what I have done for you, you will refuse to give me one red cent simply because of a single word in our solemn agreement? Have you ever tried your own hand at writing, George? Because I couldn't have put the situation into words more clearly and succinctly myself. My principles hold me to the letter of the agreement, and I am a man of principle. From that position he would not budge, and I realized it would do no good to bring up the matter of the $11 I had spent for our last lunch together, to say nothing of the quarter tip. George rose and left, and did so in such a state of histrionic despair that I couldn't bring myself to suggest that he first pay his half of the drinks. I called for the bill and noted that it came to $22. I admired George's careful arithmetic in paying himself back, and felt constrained to leave a half-dollar tip. The Evil Drink Does. "The evil drink does," said George with a heavy alcoholic sigh, "would be hard to assess." "Not if you were sober," I said. He stared at me out of his light blue eyes with a look compounded of reproach and indignation. "When," he said, "was I anything else?" "Since you were born," I said, and then realizing I was doing him an injustice, I amended my remark hastily. "Since you were weaned." "I take it," said George, "that that is one of your ineffectual attempts at humor." And with a fine absence of mind, he lifted my drink to his lips, sipped, and put it down again, holding on to it with a grip of iron. I let it go. Taking a drink from George was much akin to taking a bone from a hungry bulldog. He said, "In making my remark, I was thinking of a young woman, one in whom I took much interest, in an avuncular fashion, by the name of Ishtar Mystic." "An unusual name," I said. "But an appropriate one, for Ishtar is the name of the Babylonian goddess of love, and the veritable goddess of love is what Ishtar Mystic was, in potential, at least." "Ishtar Mystic," George said, "was what would be called a fine figure of a woman, if one had a congenital tendency to deal in understatement. Her face was beautiful in the classic sense, every feature perfect, and it was crowned by an aureole of golden hair that was so fine and sparkling as to seem a halo. Her body could only be described as aphrodisian. It was billowing and beautiful, a combination of firmness and yieldingness encased in smooth perfection. You may wonder, thanks to your foul mind, how I am so aware of the tactile state of her charms, but I assure you it is a long-distance assessment that I can make because of my general experience in such matters, and not because of any direct observation in this particular case. Fully dressed, she would make a better centerfold than any you might find in the more ordinary fashion of display in the magazines devoted to the artistic views of such things. A narrow waist, topped and bottomed by such equibalanced lushness as you could not well imagine without having seen her. Long legs, graceful arms, her every movement designed for rapture. And although one could scarcely be so coarse-grained as to demand anything more of such physical perfection, Ishtar also had a keen and supple mind, having completed her studies at Columbia University with a magna cum laude, though one might fairly suppose that the average college professor, in grading Ishtar Mystic, might feel moved to give her the benefit of the doubt. Since you yourself are a professor, my dear friend, and I say this without meaning to hurt your feelings, I can have only the lowest opinion of the profession generally. One might have thought that, with all this, Ishtar could have her pick of men, and renew her pick from a fresh batch each day. In fact, it had crossed my mind now and then that if she ever picked me, I would endeavor to meet the challenge out of my gentlemanly regard for the fair sex. But I must admit I hesitated to make that fact clear to her. For if Ishtar did have a slight fault, it was that she was rather a formidable creature. She was not more than an inch above 6 feet, had a voice which, when she was moved, rather resembled a trumpet call, and had been known to have turned on a fairly large hoodlum, who had incautiously tried to take liberties with her, lifting him bodily and tossing him across the road, a rather wide one, and into a lamppost. He spent 6 months in the hospital. There was a certain reluctance on the part of the male population to make any advances in her direction, therefore, even of the most respectful kind. The undeniable impulse to do so was always aborted by a long consideration as to whether it was physically safe to make the attempt. Even I myself, brave as a lion though you know me to be, found myself thinking of the possibility of broken bones. Thus, to coin a phrase, conscience doth make cowards of us all. Ishtar well understood the situation, and complained to me of it bitterly. I remember the occasion very well. It was a gorgeous late spring day, and we occupied a bench in Central Park. It was the occasion, I recall, when no fewer than 3 joggers failed to negotiate a curve while turning to look at Ishtar, and ended up nose to bark with a tree. "I am likely to remain virginal all my life," she said, her deliciously curved lower lip trembling. "No one seems interested in me, no one at all, and I will be 25 soon." "You understand, my dear," I said, cautiously reaching toward her to pat her hand, "that young men are in awe of your physical perfection and do not feel worthy of you."
"That is ridiculous,"
she said, forcefully enough for distant passers-by to turn inquiringly in our direction.
"What you're trying to say is that they are scared silly of me. There's something about the way in which those silly things look up at me when we're introduced and rub their knuckles after we shake hands, which just tells me that nothing will happen. They just say, 'Pleased to meet you,' and move away quickly."
"You have to encourage them, Ishtar dear. You must look upon a man as a fragile flower who can bloom properly only under the warm sunshine of your smile. Somehow you must indicate to him that you are receptive to his advances, and refrain from any attempt to seize him by the collar of his jacket and the seat of his pants and bash his head against the wall."
"I have never done that," she said indignantly. "Hardly ever. And how on earth do you expect me to indicate myself to be receptive? I smile and say, 'How do you do,' don't I? And I always say, 'What a nice day it is,' even when it isn't."
"Not enough, my dear. You must take a man's arm and tuck it gently under your own. You might tweak a man's cheek, stroke his hair, nibble daintily at his fingertips. Little things like that are indicative of a certain interest, a certain willingness on your part to engage in friendly hugs and kisses." Ishtar looked horrified.
"I couldn't do that. I just couldn't. I was brought up in the strictest possible way. It is impossible for me to behave in anything but the most correct manner. It must be the man who makes the advances, and even then I must hold back as hard as I can. My mother always taught me that."
"But, Ishtar, do it when your mother isn't looking."
"I couldn't. I'm just too inhibited. Why can't a man just come at me?"
She flushed at some thought that must have passed through her mind at those words, and her large but perfectly shaped hand clutched at her heart. I wondered idly if she knew how privileged her hand was at such a time. I think it was the word inhibited that gave me my idea. I said, "Ishtar, my child, I have it. You must indulge in alcoholic beverages. There are a number that are quite pleasant-tasting and lend one a healthful invigoration. If you were to invite a young man to share several grasshoppers with you, or margaritas, or any of a dozen other drinks I might mention, you would find that your inhibitions would quickly decrease, and so would his. He would be emboldened to make suggestions to you that no gentleman should make to a lady, and you would be emboldened to giggle when he did so, and suggest that you visit a hotel of your acquaintance where your mother would not find you." Ishtar sighed and said, "How wonderful that would be! But it wouldn't work." "Certainly it would. Almost any man would be glad to join you in a drink. If he hesitates, offer to pick up the check. No man of any worth whatever would refuse a drink when a lady offers to..." She interrupted. "That's not it. It's my problem. I can't drink." I had never heard of such a thing. "You merely open your mouth, my dear." "I know that. I can drink. I mean, I can swallow the stuff. It's the effect on me. It makes me very woozy." "But you don't drink that much. One drink makes me woozy, except when it makes me sick and I throw up. I've tried lots of times, and I just can't have more than one drink. And once I have it, I am really in no mood for, you know. It's a defect in my metabolism, I believe. But my mother says it's a gift from heaven designed to keep me virtuous against the wiles of wicked men who would try to deprive me of my purity." I must admit that I was left nearly speechless for a moment at the thought of someone who would actually find merit in an inability to indulge in the pleasures of the grape. But the thought of such perversity hardened my resolution and threw me into such a state of indifference to danger that I actually squeezed the resilience of Ishtar's upper arm and said, "My child, leave it to me. I shall arrange everything." I knew exactly what I had to do. I have undoubtedly never mentioned my friend Azazel to you, for on this subject I am totally discreet. I see you are about to protest that you know of him, and considering your well-known record as a despiser of truth, if I may say this without intention of embarrassing you, I am not surprised. Azazel is a demon possessed of magical powers. A small demon. He is, in point of fact, merely 2 centimeters tall. That, however, is good, since it makes him quite anxious to demonstrate his worth and ability to one like myself, whom he is pleased to consider an inferior being. He responded to my call, as always, although it is useless of you to expect me to give you the details of the method I use for obtaining his presence. It would be beyond your puny brain, no offense, to control him. He arrived rather out of humor. Apparently, he was watching something in the nature of a sporting event on which he had wagered close to 100,000 zakinis, and he seemed a little put out at not being able to witness the result. I pointed out that money was dross, and that he was put in this universe to help intelligences in need, and not to pile up worthless zakinis, which he would, in any case, lose upon the next bet, even if he won them now, which was doubtful. These rational and unanswerable points did nothing at first to calm down the miserable creature whose predominant characteristic is a rather disgusting tendency to selfishness. So I offered him a $0.25. Aluminum is, I believe, the medium of exchange in his world, and while it is not my intention to encourage him to expect a material return for the trifling assistance he might give me, I gathered the quarter was something in excess of 100,000 zakinis to him, and, in consequence, he rather handsomely admitted that my concerns were of more importance than his own. As I always say, the force of reason is bound to make itself felt eventually. I explained Ishtar's problem, and Azazel said,
"For once you have set me a reasonable problem."
"Of course," I said. "After all, as you know, I am not an unreasonable man. I need only have my own way to be satisfied."
"Yes," said Azazel. "Your miserable species does not metabolize alcohol efficiently, so that intermediate products accumulate in the bloodstream, and these produce various unpleasant symptoms associated with intoxication, a word appropriately derived, my studies of your dictionaries assure me, from Greek words meaning poison within."
I sneered. The modern Greeks, as you know, mix their wine with rosin, and the ancient Greeks mixed it with water. It was no wonder they spoke of poison within when they had poisoned the wine before ever drinking it in the first place. Azazel went on.
It will only be necessary to adjust the enzymes appropriately in order to have her metabolize the alcohol swiftly and unerringly to the stage of the two-carbon fragment, which is the metabolic crossroads for fat, carbohydrate, and protein metabolism. And there will then be no evidence of intoxication at all. Alcohol will thus become a wholesome food for her.
We have to have some intoxication, Azazel. Just enough to produce a healthful indifference to foolish strictures learned at the maternal knee. He seemed to understand me at once.
Ah, yes. I know about mothers. I remember my third mother telling me, Azazel, you must never clap your nictitating membranes together in front of a young Maylobe. When, how else can you...
I interrupted him again. Can you arrange for just a slight bit of accumulation of intermediate in order to produce just a wee bit of exhilaration?
Easily,
said Azazel, and in an unlovely display of greed, stroked the quarter I gave him, which, on edge, was taller than he was. It was not till about a week later that I had a chance to test Ishtar. It was in a midtown hotel bar where she illuminated the place to the point where several patrons put on dark glasses and stared. She giggled.
What are we doing here? You know I can't drink.
This won't be a drink, dear girl. Not a drink. It's just a peppermint squash. You'll like it. I had prearranged matters and signaled for a grasshopper. She sipped at it delicately and said,
Oh, it is good.
Then leaned back and allowed it to pour down her throat with abandon. She passed the tip of her beautiful tongue over her equally beautiful lips and said, May I have another?
Of course, I said genially.
At least you might have one were it not for the fact that I seem to have foolishly left my wallet.
Oh, I'll pay. I have lots of money.
A beautiful woman, I've always said, stands never so tall as when she stoops to take a wallet out of the purse between her feet. Under those circumstances, we drank freely. At least, she did. She had another grasshopper, then a vodka, then a double whiskey and soda, and a few other things. And when it was all down, she showed absolutely no sign of intoxication, though her winsome smile was more intoxicating than anything she had imbibed. She said,
I feel so nice and warm, and so ready, if you know what I mean.
I thought I did, but I wished to jump to no conclusions.
I don't think your mother would like it.
Testing, testing.
She said, What does my mother know about it? Nothing. And what is she going to know about it? Nothing.
She looked at me speculatively, and then leaned over and lifted my hand to her perfect lips.
Where can we go? She said.
Well, my friend, I think you know my feeling about such things. To refuse a young lady who asks with yearning politeness for a simple favor is not something I am likely to do. I've been brought up to be a gentleman at all times. But on this occasion, several thoughts occurred to me. First, though you might scarcely credit this, I am a little, just a touch, past my best days. And a woman as young and strong as Ishtar might take some time to satisfy, if you understand me. Then, afterward, if she should remember what had happened, and should choose to resent it, and to feel as though I had taken advantage of her, the consequences might be uncomfortable. She was a creature of impulse, and she might produce a handful of broken bones before I had a chance to explain. So I suggested a walk to my rooms, and took the long route. The fresh evening air cleared her head of its mild warmth, and I was safe. Others were not. More than one young man came to tell me of Ishtar, for, as you know, there is something about the benign dignity of my bearing that elicits confidences. It was never in a bar, unfortunately, for the men in question seemed to avoid bars for a time, at least. They had usually tried to match Ishtar drink for drink, for just a while, with unhappy results. I'm absolutely positive, one of them said, that she had a hidden pipe that led from the corner of her mouth down to a hogshead under the table, but I couldn't spot it. But if you think that was something, you should have been there later. The poor fellow was gaunt with the horror of the experience. He tried to tell me, but he was almost incoherent. The demands, he kept saying over and over again. Insatiable, insatiable. I was glad I had had the good sense to avoid something that men in their prime had barely survived.